The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Teen Vogue and The Atlantic. My first article today is from Teen Vogue, and it's in light of Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, which is the month of May. Teen Vogue, in honor of that month, is shining a light on the full spectrum of, including the history that you're not taught in school and cultural contributions that we'd all be worse off from the AAPI community. This article is titled Michelle Wu, Boston Mayoral Candidate on AAPI Heritage and Mental Health Stigma. And this was published on May 18th, 2021. I grew up with a keen understanding of the invisible barriers my immigrant parents faced and the ways in which my family stuck out. As the oldest kid in our family, born just a year after my parents arrived in the U.S. from Taiwan, I was their translator and interpreter from a young age. In public, we learned to brush off the not infrequent racist sounds shouted after us and people pulling at our eyes, at their eyes. But I also learned to be on guard in mostly safe spaces like school after classmates expressed disgust at the foods my parents packed for my lunch. I stopped talking about some of my favorite treats, such as dried seaweed and seasoned pig ears. When I was six, my mom saved up and sent me to a two-day manner school for children, where I learned how to sit still at a fancy dinner table, use silverware in the right order, and chew with my mouth closed. It was a bewildering experience, as I had never seen so many utensils on a table at once, and wouldn't again until I arrived at college a dozen years later. At home, we always ate dinner with chopsticks. Years later, at my college's freshman orientation dinner, staring down at all those rows of forks and knives, spoons in different directions, all I could think of was how my mom had sacrificed to ensure that her kids would be able to navigate the barriers that she could not. I'm an Asian American woman, a mom of two young kids, and an elected official. Growing up, I wouldn't have believed that combination to be possible, and I certainly couldn't have imagined that it would be my journey, from introverted daughter of immigrants to caregiver for a mom living with mental illness and candidate for mayor of Boston. May is Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and this year, still reeling from incidents of anti-Asian racism and violence across the country, I join members of the Asian American community in challenging AAPI invisibility through speaking out and telling our stories. May is also Mental Health Awareness Month, and I share my family's story to help break stigmas and take down barriers for treatment and building community. The first time my mom was hospitalized for her mental health, it was after she had been outside in the rain, experiencing an intense episode of paranoia and delusions, when someone called the police. I begged the officer not to take her to the police station, so I called an ambulance and said she had to get in. When they let me see her in the emergency room, she was already in a hospital gown and had been forcibly sedated. A staff member handed me a plastic bag containing her belongings, clothes they had cut off her body with scissors. Mom later told me, in Mandarin, that she hadn't wanted to undress in front of a male attendant. In the very place where she was supposed to get help, no one was even trying to understand her. In the face of stigma and shame, my mom's response to her advancing mental illness had been to keep her head down, keep going, doing what she had to do. But as the paranoia grew, she stopped eating and sleeping regularly and started calling 911 in the middle of the night to report cries for help that no one else could hear. When I turned 23, my parents got a divorce. As she became a single mom, I moved back home to become her caregiver and raise my sisters, then 10 and 16 years old. When it comes to mental health, we are too often pressured to compartmentalize and hide the parts of ourselves that need the most support. As a young adult, I found myself switching from dealing with the discomfort of being the only Asian face in the room to helping my mother navigate a mental illness she had never learned to describe. Just as I navigated between two worlds in Manor School, I was navigating between my mom's immigrant experience and hospitals in her native tongue and the English spoken by the doctors. But we have the power to change the conversation. I ran for office to break down barriers for families and connect all of our residents to opportunity. As the first Asian American woman elected to the Boston City Council and the first woman of color to serve as council president, I've had the honor of serving our city and helping to reshape policies and politics in Boston. Our leadership has changed the conversation on what is possible for our city and beyond. We've built coalitions to pass legislation that closes gaps for families, including paid parental leave, language access, health care equity, housing stability, and food justice. And we're leading the way for a Boston Green New Deal, fare free public transportation, investing in community schools, and mental health. I've seen the wide gaps facing our families when government doesn't work, but I also know the power of city government to deliver urgent change. That's why I'm running for mayor, to make Boston a city for everyone. Instead of forcing people to navigate between identities, our government needs to serve the whole individual and every community. Instead of ignoring the voices that most need support, we must rebuild our systems to center these voices in driving progress. Today, my mom lives downstairs in our two-family home. Though she still has up and down days with her mental health challenges, my 3 and 6-year-old sons are blessed to be able to eat breakfast with their grandmother most mornings, and she blesses us with her wisdom and love. So many stories are, like my family's, complex and intersectional. As the pandemic has deepened and exposed the systemic injustices that communities were facing long before COVID-19, our recovery must be as intersectional as it is bold. Now is the moment to build the cities we dream of, anchored in a movement that ensures everyone in our community is seen, supported, and treasured. Our next article is from The Atlantic, and this was a part of The Atlantic's Inheritance, which is a project about American history and Black life. And this article is titled, "The 1970s Black Utopian City That Became a Modern Ghost Town: What the Demise of an Experimental Black Town Reveals About the Struggle for Racial Equality Today." This is by Thomas Healy, a professor at Seton Hall Law School, and was published on February 16th of 2021. Visit Soul City, North Carolina today, and you won't find much. An abandoned healthcare clinic stripped by vandals, a pool and recreation center with no trespassing sign, a 1970s subdivision with streets that are cracked and crumbling, and an industrial plant that has been converted into a prison. If not for the concrete monolith with the words Soul City cast in red iron, you might not know that this was supposed to be a city at all. But that's what the civil rights leader Floyd McKissick hoped to create when he arrived here in 1969 with dreams of transforming an old slave plantation into a new city an hour north of Raleigh. The city would be dedicated to Black economic empowerment, McKissick envisioned, bringing money and opportunity to an area left behind by the modern by the modern economy and reversing the exodus of black people to the northern slums. He projected that by the year 2000, it would boast 24,000 jobs and a population of 50,000. Soul City never came close to those projections. When development stopped 10 years later, there were just 135 jobs and 124 full-time residents. In the four decades since, Soul City has quietly faded into oblivion, becoming a modern-day ghost town. Most people, even in North Carolina, have never heard of it. That's unfortunate. The history of Soul City is worth remembering as the country continues to grapple with the legacy of segregation and slavery. McKissick's unrealized dream offers a window into the struggle for racial equality and the many forces, social, political, and economic, that continue to stand in the way. A lawyer by profession, McKissick rose to prominence as the head of the Congress of Racial Equality, one of the foremost civil rights groups of the 1960s. He was a fiery speaker and a visionary leader, but he had neither the experience nor the resources needed to build a city. And the site he chose was an unlikely location for an urban utopia, 5,000 acres of farmland in one of the poorest parts of the state, with no water or sewer systems, no paved roads, and no electrical grid. It also lay smack in the middle of what one roadside billboard boldly proclaimed as Klan country. Perhaps the biggest obstacle was the idea itself. Although Soul City was meant to be integrated, McKissick made clear that his main goal was to help black people, especially the poor and the unemployed. For that reason, and because of its name, Soul City was quickly branded an experiment in black nationalism, a sort of domestic Liberia. This played well in certain circles, but to many who had fought for integration, or at least come to accept it, Soul City seemed like a step backwards. As one Southern newspaper put it, "How terribly tragic it would be should all civil rights roads cut in the past 20 years lead to Soul City, a Camelot built on racism." In reality, McKissick's dream was about economic equality, not separatism. It is true that he had emerged as a spokesperson for black power and that his rhetoric was often inflammatory. "If white America does not respond to peaceful protest," he wrote in his book, Three-Fifths of a Man, "black people will be forced to work for their liberation through violent revolution." But he had also spent his entire life challenging racial barriers. He integrated the University of North Carolina Law School in 1951. His children desegregated Durham Public Schools in 1958. And he led nonviolent protest against segregated buses, lunch counters, dime stores, ice cream parlors, swimming pools, bathrooms, and water fountains for 2 decades. Over the years, however, McKissick became frustrated by the slow pace of change. Like many black leaders, he realized that marches and demonstrations, lawsuits and legislation could achieve only so much. For black people to be truly free, they needed power, economic power. If a black man has no bread in his pocket, the solution to his problem is not integration, McKissick liked to say. It's to go get some bread. That's why, although McKissick had no desire to exclude white people, his dream was to build a city where black Americans would call the shots, owning banks and businesses, running the police department and the school system, directing health care and social services. In the summer of 1972, after the Nixon administration awarded Soul City a $14 million loan guarantee, which is about $87 million today, to prepare the land for development, that dream appeared within reach. The loan was part of a program financing 13 new communities across the country, including a futuristic high-rise complex near downtown Minneapolis and an eco-friendly exurb of Houston. But Soul City was the only project in a rural area and the only one led by a black developer. And federal support did not come cheaply. McKissick changed his party affiliation from Democrat to Republican and endorsed Richard Nixon's 1972 re-election campaign because he thought it was necessary to guarantee government support. The alliance was bizarre. Nixon, the law and order president, whose Southern strategy exploited racism to win white votes, and McKissick, the militant black leader who was under surveillance by the FBI. Conservatives questioned Nixon's judgment, while black leaders accused McKissick of selling out. But like most political unions, it offered mutual benefits. For Nixon, backing Soul City was a chance to improve his image among black voters without risking white support. Instead of embracing civil rights and welfare, he portrayed Soul City as a capitalistic solution to the problems of race and poverty. McKissick, meanwhile, desperately needed federal funds to get Soul City off the ground. Although he had secured private loans to purchase the land, investors were not lining up to bankroll or speculative. Investors were not lining up to bankroll a speculative new town. If becoming a Republican meant he could get the money he needed, he was prepared to take whatever heat came his way. The loan guarantee gave Soul City a jolt of momentum. Major corporations such as General Motors signaled an interest in building factories in the town. The governor of North Carolina offered financial support, and the national press weighed in enthusiastically. An editorial in the Washington Post praised Soul City as the most vital experiment yet in the country's halting struggle against the cancer of hectic urbanization. And the New York Times called it a sane and practical as well as imaginative concept. Within a few years, Soul City was a bustling development, with a staff of 70 and a population just under 100. Workers cleared the land, paved the roads, and opened a healthcare center, while construction began on a regional water system and the first industrial plant. Even McKissick skeptics began to come around, and one local official declared Soul City the best thing to happen to the area in the last 100 years. So, what happened? How did a project that once held such promise fall so depressingly short of its goals? Like many utopian projects, Soul City was in part a victim of its own ambition. Attempting to build a community out of nothing, but the red clay of the Carolina Piedmont was a massive undertaking that would have daunted the most experienced and well-financed white developer. For a black man without deep pockets or corporate backing, battling the economic downturns of the 1970s, it was a highly improbable venture. It wasn't impossible, though, as evidenced by the fact that other new cities of the period did survive. Cities such as The Woodlands, Texas, Columbia, Maryland, and Reston, Virginia. These cities faced many of the same challenges as Soul City, with one primary exception. They were built by white developers, financed by white corporations, and populated largely by white people. What doomed Soul City was not just the size of its ambition, but, at least in part, its color. Like nearly every other effort to improve the lives of black people, it was subjected to a level of scrutiny, second-guessing, and outright hostility that other ventures rarely encounter. The race-baiting politician Jesse Helms, elected to the Senate from North Carolina in 1972, repeatedly attacked the project as a boondoggle and a waste of taxpayer money. A series of articles in the Raleigh News and Observer falsely accused McKissick of fraud and corruption, and a congressional audit of the development stalled progress for 9 months, only to clear Soul City of the charges leveled against it. This is not to suggest that bigotry alone doomed Soul City. Many white Americans who rejected Soul City, such as Claude Sitton, the legendary civil rights reporter for the New York Times, who had become editor of the News and Observer, were not overtly racist. They were integrationists who thought Soul City was the wrong path to racial equality. Yet their opposition denied black Americans the one thing they desired most, self-determination. As one black preacher precisely observed in 1973, it's white folks, not black folks, who are going to decide whether Soul City will be a reality. The federal government deserves to share blame, too. After encouraging Soul City's development, it failed to offer needed resources and support, leading to costly delays and missed opportunities. Wary of public scrutiny and cowed by political opposition, it imposed conditions on Soul City that were not imposed in other new towns, insisting on industrial commitments before releasing the loan guarantee and then preventing McKissick from using that loan to build houses and commercial buildings. And when the scrutiny and opposition intensified, the government lacked the conviction to stand by McKissick, pulling the plug on the project in 1979. The self-defeating pride of McKissick should not be overlooked either. Determined that Soul City would be a monument for black achievement, he sometimes undermined his assurances that it would be integrated, telling one reporter that he wanted to live with my people. And although McKissick was generally a pragmatist, as demonstrated by his alliance with Nixon, he was unwilling to compromise on the one aspect of the plan that many white businesses and prospective residents objected to, the town's name, which centered and celebrated black culture. Viewing that opposition as racist, which it often was, McKissick declared, "If I change the name, I will have lived my life for nothing." When the federal government foreclosed on Soul City, the people who had bought houses there were left holding the bag. With no industry and no source of revenue, the infrastructure and facilities that had been slowly decayed, although more than 100 people remained, including McKissick, who died in 1991, the town itself was wiped off the map, reverting to a private homeowners association. Yet, the story of Soul City is more relevant than ever. In the half century since McKissick conceived of Soul City, the financial gap between black and white households has hardly budged. The black unemployment rate is nearly double the white rate, and the median net worth of black Americans is one-tenth that of white Americans. More importantly, black people are still seeing the self-determination that McKissick hoped Soul City would provide in 1969. Black people are still seeking the self-determination that McKissick hoped Soul City would provide in 1969. When protests erupted in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, black residents were not just lamenting the death of Michael Brown, the young man shot by a police officer. Although the incident triggered the unrest, the frustration and bitterness had been building for decades, as the percentage of black residents increased, but white residents retained control of all aspects of the city government. By 2014, Ferguson's population was 67% black and 30% white. Yet its government was staffed almost entirely by white people, including the mayor's office, the school board, and the police department, which had only 3 black officers out of a force of 53. What black residents in Ferguson were demanding then, and what black residents in Baltimore, Charlotte, Minneapolis, and so many other cities are demanding today, is the same thing that McKissick was seeking 5 decades earlier: respect, dignity, and control over their own destiny. No quick or easy solution exists for achieving these objectives, but the story of Soul City points in some obvious directions. it highlights the need for greater investment in Black communities and Black-owned businesses so that entrepreneurs are not perpetually depending on white institutions for support like McKissick was. It shows the value of diversity in business and media as an antidote to the kinds of stereotypes and misperceptions Soul City faced. It underscores the importance of protecting voting rights so that elected officials such as Helms can be held accountable for sowing bigotry and hate. Perhaps most crucial, the story of Soul City serves as a reminder that racial equality cannot be achieved without letting Black people lead the way. That does not mean accepting an idea or proposal simply because it comes from a Black leader. There is often disagreement within the Black community itself about the best path forward. But white Americans must be willing to take seriously what Black people and all people of color are saying and to have some humility about their own wisdom. Had white critics of Soul City heeded that lesson, McKissick's dream might have turned out very differently. And I want to briefly describe some cover art for this article. There is what looks to be a poster of a single-family home at the bottom, and at the top it says, Soul City, Race, Equality, and the Lost Dream of an American Utopia by Thomas Healy. And there's also an image in this article of a pamphlet for housing development in Soul City with three different images, one of two young ladies walking down the street of what was to be the future Soul City, an image of two people playing golf, what looks to be a Black man playing golf and a young lady playing golf, and then a third image, what looks to be like a market or a mall with people walking in the streets, and what was to be the future Soul City as well. There is also an image of what looks to be the sign Soul City that was described in the article, the monolith indicating that Soul City is, that you've entered Soul City. And there is an image of what looks to be a ranch style home, somewhat old, and lots of empty land behind it. And there's also two images here. From left to right, we have Floyd McKissick stands in the empty fields of Warren County, North Carolina in 1974, which is where Soul City is located. And then to the right of that is a tract plan for the first phase of Soul City. So to give you some imagery there. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Please be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.